Okay, first of all, does anyone know what this is? Can you actually, this is the best resolution I was able to find. Can you guess what it might be? What does it represent?
It's a farm?
Sorry?
There's a farm there?
Yeah, that's true.
Utopia.
Sorry?
Utopia. Kind of a utopian island.
Yeah, it's a futuristic vision of a modern research university. This is science. If you can't see it really good, I have handouts if that might be more helpful, but I can do it later. So this is science as it was envisioned in the beginning of the 17th century by Sir Francis Bacon. It's called Selwyn's House, and it was to be embodied several decades later in the institution of the early Royal Society. Now, the scientists, as Bacon envisioned them, will be experimenting and exploring all kinds of scientific matters. So what can you, I think the most obvious thing would be the little flying man up there. So this was their space program, and they actually had one. In the 1620s, they were convinced that they were going to set foot on the moon by the 1660s at the latest. So they were very interested in the manned flight program, had some experiments, many experiments performed at Oxford. Then you've got the precursor of the telephone right there. There's a submarine here, and the farm that you mentioned. There's a strange thing about this farm. The hen up there is conspicuously large, while the goat and the deer are really minute. Do you know what this is? This is GMO by 17th century standards. These are animals bred larger and smaller than their nature, so that man can manipulate them, and as well as the crops. So they're having trouble mowing all the things there because they're growing so fast. Now, animals, why am I mentioning this, emphasizing this bit? Animals played a huge part in the rise of empirical science in the 17th century. Birds, insects, mice, cats, dogs, eels, snakes, you name it, they all went to the Royal Society and never came back. Some underwent terrifying respiration experiments in the air pumps. Some were dissected alive, some had poisons injected into their veins. How did the English experimental philosophers of the time cope with the animals' expression of pain? And also, how was this received in the literary writings of the period? Finally, how do the concepts of the mechanical and the animal play against each other, the more organic play against each other in their reports? Now, these are the questions that I want to explore today. We've heard yesterday from Clara's talk about the co-constructed future, a collaborative research space between humans and animals, a convergence of doing. Now, all these things would have been alien to the 17th century. But no one would have remembered to ask a duck, hey, would you like to be stuffed into a small claustrophobic space while we suck out the air so we can see how long you can last? But there was, what is interesting is there was a strong bioethical consciousness in the time which didn't even know the term bioethics or the concept of bioethics. So if we start with the respiration experiments with the air pump, a machine which was developed by Robert Hooke and Robert Boyle in the 1650s at Oxford. It was used to test the characteristics of the air and to prove the existence of vacuum. Now, in order to do that, Boyle performed a series of experiments with smaller animals, obviously smaller because they had to fit inside the air pump. And he reported many of those experiments in the first scientific journal, Philosophical Transactions. if we look at the experiments that he performed with ducks, frogs, and kittens, we can get a sense of how the organic is usually more emphasized than the machinic aspect of the animal. Experiment number one, for example, presents to us observations made about the lasting of ducks included in the exhausted receiver. Boy wanted to see whether a duck could last longer than a bird not aquatic, for example, a hen. And this is how he describes the trial. We put a full-grown duck, being not then able to procure a fitter, into a receiver, whereof she filled, by our guess, a third part or somewhat more, but was not able to stand in any easy posture in it, then pumping out the air, though she seemed at first, which yet I am not too confident of upon a single trial, to continue well, somewhat longer than a hen in her condition would have done. Yet within the short space of 1 minute, she appeared much discomposed, and between that and the second minute, her struggling and convulsive motions increased so much that her head also hanging carelessly down, she seemed to be just at the point of death, from which we presently rescued her by letting in the air upon her. Now, is this description influenced by mechanical philosophy? Is this duck seen as a sophisticated machine or as something much more organic? Well, the duck cannot stand in any easy posture, and it is rescued. This wording, as well as the following experiment upon the duckling, make us wary of imagining Robert Boyle's duck as a piece of machinery. So the duckling is said to have grown so much worse, and then recovered, and then grew sick upon her imprisonment. So the idea of the prison is very frequently expressed in Boyle's writings, in Boyle's reports on those trials. The concept of the air pump as a prison, which holds something captive, is very present in his reports on frogs, where the distressed and disquieted frog is said to have endured the uneasy prison. The ethical concern with the welfare of the animals is especially prominent in Boyle's experiments on kittens. Boyle wanted to find out why kittens, he wanted to find out whether animals who were fresh out of the womb could survive without air longer because they were accustomed to being without the air. And after he puts the first kittling into the air pump, the first kittling survives and recovers. And then he decides to allow him the benefit of his good fortune and sends for another one. When he finishes with a second kitten, he thinks it's severe to make him undergo the same measure again and spares him the misery. The third is not so lucky, so the third dies, but the description of his death is rather poignant. He says, we took him out of the receiver and put aqua vitae in his mouth, yet he irrecoverably died in our hands. When we look at the reception of these experiments in the literary fictional writings of the period, the animal is likewise rarely perceived as an elaborate engine. Rather, the poems highlight what is already present in the experimenter's own writing. The animal is the unwilling victim that is imprisoned and in vain. In an Oxford poem that actually won an award at the annual ceremony, we read the following. Bilego presti quis, ali expirante vitis, posto mitalesces in folgo saure, cum genit tes animas simo exhalare. Yet others have, I tried to do as direct a translation as possible, yet others have I seen expire inside transparent glass as soon as the vital breath stopped coming from the bellows with a moan the innocent animals exhaled their last. There is a sense of a strong moral condemnation here. The animals are insontes, so they are innocent, guiltless, and they die with a gametus, or with a moan. They are enclosed within the transparent glass, the glass receiver of the air pump. The theme was taken up again also at Oxford in early 1690s, when young Joseph Edison wrote, a very tongue-in-cheek piece, something which was supposed to be celebrating Boyle, but it actually seems to be quite ironic. By the help of instruments like these, that air which a bountiful nature has indulged us, we, as often as we please, by the force of art, abridge other animals off and keep them in our pneumatic pumps from its common benefit. What a pleasure is it to see the fruitless heavings of the lungs, to exhaust their lives, and by a most artful sort of theft, rob them of their breath. From this nothing is safe, nothing so long lived, which gradually does not languish, and fall dead without a wound. A divine piece of art this, and worthy its author, who in the conduct of his life and the force of his arguments has so nobly honored our nation and the new philosophy. One who for this reason too deserves never to want the benefit of his own air. Or that he who has so often deprived other animals of their life should ever breathe out his own. Now, Edison relies on this juxtaposition between the animate and the inanimate. Boyle's instruments work by the force of art. They rob the animals of their breath by a most artful sort of theft, and this is called a divine piece of art. On the other hand, animals languish, their breath is extinguished, and their life lost. Now, with the air pump, you could see what was going on inside the machine with the animal. With live dissections of animals, you could see what was going on inside the animal. The invasiveness of the procedure, in which internal organs were subjected to painful scrutiny, was noted in many contemporary accounts, such as this one. Though he should vaunt himself of his having been frequently conversant in the ripping up such poor creatures alone, recount the pleasant histories of his grasping their entrails with his hands, and thrusting his fingers into their hearts while they lay groaning and panting and struggling under his knife. Although, by the way, I know no authority that either he or any else have to exercise any such cruelties over them. Nay, though they should be the whole college of the virtuosi themselves that stood by and encouraged him in what he did. But however, whether they have or not, this I am very sure of, that it is like to prove small matter of comfort to any who shall be the patience of such a one. To be ere a whit the more ruggedly dealt with all when they happen to fall under his hands. The experimental philosopher's work here is seen as a messy affair, not as a neat disassembling of the automata. The animals are ripped up, they lie groaning, panting, and struggling under the knife, very actively, and the entire institution of the Royal Society is actually condemned here. On ethical grounds, and it is suggested that the ethical considerations of the well-being of the animals should override, actually, the scientific agenda of the time. Vivisection in the poetry of the period played upon this juxtaposition of the animate and the inanimate as well. Anatomical knives were seen as cold instruments waiting to inflict pain and death on organic bodies. Now, if we return to the Oxford poem, we read the following. I'll read it to you in Latin because it really sounds very poignant. I think much better than mine. Vidip si meritas animalia solere poenas. Torcer utaque sit busili de saivio ripso. Viva que moxu tris precordia mudata cultis. So he says, I myself have seen the animal suffer undeserved punishment as the tormentor approached, more savage than Bucyrus himself, and then with sharp knives stripped bare the beating heart. Bucyrus was an Egyptian king, and it's very interesting the choice of out of all people, Bucyrus, for cruelty. He demanded the sacrifice of humans, but foreigners in particular. So it's interesting that the poet uses Bucyrus because it suggests that the animals here are seen as the other, as a non-human on which you can test all those things. The constraint and panic that you can sense here is a state of the poetry of the period when they talk about vivisection. So for example, in a poem which once again, this celebrates actually William Harvey and his discovery of the circulation of the blood. It emphasizes the panic of the dog that is about to be vivisected. And it says, lay hold of the dog, he lifts it up by squeezing its twisted neck and places it on its back onto the table. And the dog's fur bristles and stands erect, and the dog tries to wrap his arms and fills the room with its loud howls and kicks its legs. But the fates cannot be resisted. Harvey presses the dog with firm embrace, and onto the middle of the table stretches the wretch that provides much resistance in vain. Then he constrains its legs with rope and ties them with taut fetters. When the poor dog spread out like this, lies in fear and trepidation with shuddering limbs and a heaving chest. So, both in the accounts of vivisection and respiration experiments, and both in the scientific accounts by experimental philosophers themselves and by literary writers who were there to witness those, especially students at Oxford, they were there to witness the experiments. And then they just went back home and scribbled something about it. They betray the duality of the concepts of the animate and the inanimate, of the machinic and of the mechanical and the organic. And they do not seem to see animals as merely a superior of machines, like divine machines, which are much better than our own machines. And to conclude, I would just like to quote what Tom Brown, quoting Fontenelle, said about the difference between machines and animals. So his only point was, when he wrote to a contemporary Cartesian, he said, "You pretend that beasts are no less machines than watches. Now, I dare engage that if you put a certain machine called a dog and another machine called a bitch together in the same room, there will result a third little machine from the corresponding together. Whereas you may keep two watches together as long as you live. Then tell doomsday if you please, and they will never produce a third watch between them. Now, I find by philosophy that any two things that have the faculty to produce a third out of themselves are a class much superior to that of machines." Thank you very much. It has to do with the Royal Society, of course, obviously, but it's Oxford at that time became particularly a hub of experimental activity, and those vivisection just spread like fire. They were, of course, there were dissections, vivisections of animals before that, all the way from the 16th century. Medical practice depended very much on actual medical research depended on animal dissection. But it is especially, those poems seem to be prolific at the end of the 17th century, more than in the beginning.
Yeah. I think I just called back first. Yeah, by the fairly horrific description of the dog at the end. I don't know how far